Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 24, titled The Ethics of Enlightened Self-Interest.
Now, in Buddhist ethics, there's something called the Tenfold Path of positive action and a Tenfold Path of negative action. The sort of ethical precepts are arranged like that. And usually the word kushala in Sanskrit, kushala karma patha, that means path of karma, which is kushala. And usually people translate kushala as virtuous or non-virtuous. And Tibetan gewa and mingewa. But actually the word kushala in Sanskrit doesn't mean virtuous. It means skillful and unskillful, which is odd. Why would it be called ethical action skillful or unskillful? Why was that? The gewa, it doesn't quite get that connotation in Tibetan as like keba. Gewa and keba don't really fit. So they picked some aspect of the word kushala, but not the skillful aspect, you know. Like tabla keba is upaya kaushalya, which is also from kushala, you know. Now, what is skillful about it? This is so interesting. It took me years to sort of think of this, actually, I must say. Well, if you are an evolutionary being, and if your evolution does depend on the true choices that you make as a conscious person, and you are not a helpless victim of Darwin, Marx, or Freud, but you have actually conscious choice on your path, then you can choose skillfully or unskillfully to have a good outcome, right? In other words, if you go right or left, if you go right, you get to where you're going, left, you get lost in the woods. Right? That's skillful or unskillful, right? Which is a completely different idea than being good or bad. Do you follow me? You know, daddy's going to punish you, you know, in a religious or theistic ethical system. God tells you do this, and you get punished if you don't, and you get rewarded if you do. You know, so that's good or bad, right or wrong, right? Now, or right or wrong can go to either way. All right. Now, the tenfold path of skillful, and I translate karma as evolutionary action, because karma is not any action, it is motivated action, which is done out of conscious motivation and choice, and which therefore gives a reaction or an effect to the actor, in addition to whatever they act upon. So if you act a certain way, you know, like that kind of principle you can see in Western proverbs, like who lives by the sword dies by the sword. So that's evolutionary action. In other words, you're a killer. You're, you know, Arnold, you're macho, you're Rambo, and then you become more like a killer, you know, stronger, more harsh, less sensitive to others, more ruthless, you know, like House of Cards. I don't know if any of you ever saw House of Cards, but the beginning, first session of House of Cards, the guy strangled the dog. That's supposedly a nice thing because it's going to be a problem to take it to the vet. And remember, there's a dog whining, he's been hit by a car, and he strangled it. It's just to let you know what the program is about. It was like Clinton in 1992, in order to deal with the right-wingers who think of old Democrats as liberal wimps, he rushed back to Arkansas and executed a couple of death row prisoners. Remember that? Mm-hmm. He just went back and pulled the lever on a couple just to kind of keep up with the Texans, you know, who are executing people. Just a political thing. He did. Clinton is kind of like, I feel your pain, yeah. So I call it evolutionary action in the sense that it's action that gives an effect on the actor. Now, there are sort of three physical ones, four verbal ones, and three mental ones. The path of skillful positive or negative evolutionary action. You know, it's like plus or minus, right? Now, again, remember, what is the goal of evolution from Buddha's point of view? Well, Buddha is a happy camper. He says, wow, I'm cool. I have, you know, You know, sabshi turtle ursel dumaje, ursel turtle dumaje. Dudzi tawa chuchi gornye. You know, I have found a reality like an elixir of immortality. Dudzi, you know, like Amrita Devi's. Actually, Amrita Devi helped him, I think, deal with the devil. And which is profound, peaceful, luminous, without complication or elaboration, and uncreated. That's the reality I have discovered, he said. Then he says, if I tell anybody about it, they won't get it, so I'm going to just hang out in the forest. Sula tenjankor minduve, mima, nakitel, chiburne. He says, because if I show it to anybody, they won't get it, so I'm going to stay at Menla and hang out by myself in the forest. That's what he said, right?
He did,
long.
4 years.
No, he was only 49 days he stayed.
49 days.
Remember, he stayed there. But he was just playing coy, you know. He was waiting for God to come and ask him to go teach, actually, if you look at the story. Brahma comes down and says, oh, come on, Buddha, go teach people. And then the God creates a vision for Buddha of a bunch of a lotus pond, and then rainfall on the lotus pond, and then some lotuses sort of bloom and some don't. And so he said, the people are like these lotuses, and when the rain of the Dharma falls on them, the teaching, that is, then some will bloom later and all this. You know. So they have a big thing where the God comes and makes him teach, you know, Brahma. And Brahma wants him to teach because Brahma's tired of being blamed for bad things happening to people. So that he's omnipotent, who think he's omnipotent, you know. So that's what he says, right? So he's happy, but why? Because he had an experience of being vastly expanded where he identified with the entire universe, with all beings. And somehow he doesn't think that's a nightmare. He didn't experience it as a horrible thing. Like, you know, you had a headache yesterday. If I was Buddha, I would have had the headache with you. That would have been... Oh, I don't want to have that headache. I just want a headache. Here, have a pill or take some nutmeg or whatever, you know. So, but Buddha somehow, because he saw beings as blissful, like I said the other day, you know, as he says, he didn't mind identifying with all beings. In fact, that's the ideal way to be. There's no problem with self and other because everybody is yourself. And then you really see their highest potential in them. And then you also have the energy because of the bliss and the vastness of the universe, to do whatever it takes to try to help them get there as quick as possible. So it's really not a problem. Whereas he remembered when he was Prince Siddhartha, and he was supposed to be the great prince, and he realized other people were annoyed about it or freaked out. He couldn't do anything. His wife wasn't really happy. His husband, father, he couldn't satisfy people. And life was very difficult when he was like a self-enclosed person, shut in himself, and different from others, and worried about what to do for them in a good sense, maybe afraid of them in a bad sense, right? Like the ordinary person's way of being when they feel different from the universe. So, to him, evolution means expanding from a very isolated, alienated person, individual in the real sort of physical sense of undividable, because you're absolutely there, you're like an atom being, and you're just always there, and then you're different from everything else, and it's all sweeping you off here and there, and you're never going to manage, which is the truth of suffering and the cause of suffering, of your being isolated and thinking you're the absolute center and separate center of everything, and then the rest of it not agreeing with that, right? So we want to evolve from that to where you're vast bliss, and you can even incorporate everybody else in that bliss. That's the ultimate peak of evolution, let's call it. As far as he saw it. I mean, he may be crazy. I don't know. I'm not one myself. So I don't know. But that's what he sensed. That's what it's defined as. So if you see it like that, you know, look at a beetle. You know, look at a little bug on the earth, you know. Or even one of those bacteria. It's like a little Pac-Man going around, packing around, munching something in front of it. And being munched by something behind it. And, you know, chigla chiksa, we say. The animal suffering is one eating another, you know. And you're just really different from other things. And you eat what you can in front of you, but then you're eaten from behind. And there's a lot more eating you than you can eat, you know. So that's really your whole existence is like that. That's a very low evolution, right? Then you get much more complicated. You start attracting cells and bacteria that kind of get along in your stomach. They like each other. They have a party down there as long as you don't poison them too much. And then they build you up. And then they come and make a brain. And then the brain you can see about others. And then you become a mammal. And then a mammal, the females of the mammal do a really weird thing, which is they invite an actual other strange person in there. And they're suddenly, oh, what? I thought I was here. What? Who are you? You know? It is a stranger at first, right? Remember Mae West, I always depend on the kindness of strangers. Every human being depends on the kindness of strangers. Because you fall in love with that mom in the bardo from a Buddhist point of view. She's a stranger. She's kind of cute when she's having an orgasm. But normally she might be a little dangerous. And then you're suddenly in her belly. And then she's sort of, oh, who are you? I mean, you might be, you know, Hitler in there. Who knows? You know what I'm saying? But that's a mammal is already has, therefore, especially the female, realizes that the envelope of the skin does not define self and other. She has like a rather harsh lesson in that, right? Male, there was no idea about that, really. They just run around, you know, here and there. Get off my toe, much less get out of my belly. It's a male. So that's why males are more backward in an evolutionary sense from Buddhist real deep medical point of view. Gelan was hinting at it about all the women, doctors, and everything. And Dalai Lama has hinted at it. You know. Dalai Lama said, since we can't have a war anymore in this world, that it's and women are less inclined to violence than men, I think maybe I should reincarnate as a woman, he said. And all Tibetan male chauvinists got, oh, no, we can't do that. Dalai Lama's a woman. Oh, no. The Tibetans are still a little chauvinists, many of them. And then the Dalai Lama was in Rome when he said that at least one time. He said it a number of times, but one famous time in Rome, or in Livorno, I think, in Italy. So when he said it, he said, and in that case, he said, I'll be much more attractive. And he went like that. He made a modeling gesture. In Livorno, you know, near Pisa. Yeah. So, I think that's great. I got to put that in a comic book, actually. I forgot to put that scene in. So finally get to be a mammal, and then among mammals, finally get to be a human being who's very confused about what they are, human beings. The greatness of human beings is not that they're violent hunters, you know, come out of the Paleolithic and beat up the Neanderthals, and the whole legend of the militaristic America promoted by, you know, the biologists in MIT and places like that to try to convince us that we are really violent automatically, and therefore the Russians will get us unless we keep paying for the Pentagon. That's all built baloney. The human being is a chicken. You know, we're chickens. In the sense of chicken shit, sorry, to speak bluntly, we are. And we don't have armored skin like a rhino. We don't have a big horn. We don't spit poison like a snake. We don't have big fangs even. We couldn't go toe-to-toe with a tiger or any animal more or less. Tarzan occasionally manages, but that's in the movies. And we really are like soft. You know, we have soft skin, wimpy fingernails. You break them all the time. You know, and no fangs except those vampires in Hollywood. And so, why? Because we're social interconnecting. We're helpless infants for a decade, then helpless adolescents who think we're omnipotent for a decade, then we're in our 20s trying to pay off student debt, and it's terrible. So we're very, very like that. But we're very sensitive, on the other hand, and very intelligent. We can empathize with another person. We have a highly developed, what they call mirror neurons, to empathize with others. You know, the Italians, again, discovered these mirror neurons. Did you know that? Because they were doing some monkey experiments in labs, making monkeys do things with electrodes on their heads, you know, the horrible things they do, and to see what happens in the brain, you know. And then they had a monkey who was on the bench, you know. He was, like, out of the game, and he was sitting on the bench, but they left the electrodes on. Somehow they put new electrodes on the new monkey who was jumping around. So then they noticed that the monkey who was watching the other monkey, the brain was having him do all the things the monkey was doing, mirroring, but you know, mentally imitating whatever the other monkey was doing. So then from that they discovered the empathy neurons, the mirror neuron, what they call mirror neuron, our natural compassion, in other words, you know. It's really very cool. Italians did that, you know. And so you're smart being in Rome.
There are many Italians.
What?
There are many Italians.
Good, good. So I think your children are practically half Italian now, right? They are. Which is good. So my point is, and then the human, therefore, if your evolutionary goal is to expand, to be able to identify with the universe in a visceral sense of such identification, while also being able to tolerate the differences as well in order to maneuver in a helpful manner within the universe, in that multiple bodies, actually, even, it's such an extravagant vision of evolution. You know, it's a thought being, almost, you could say, like a Buddha becomes. What is skillful evolution is whatever expands your sense and ability to identify. Do you follow? And whatever contracts your ability to identify is unskillful. Okay, now go to the first skillful path of evolutionary action and unskillful path of evolutionary action. What is the first one? Killing or saving life. When you kill another being, what are you saying? I don't identify with you and your possession of your body, or if I'm a materialist, all you are is your body, and that's not part of my world. I don't need it, unless I'm going to eat you or use your skin for my shoes or my hat or whatever, you know, use you in some way. But otherwise, you're not in my world. I don't care about you. I don't identify with you. Do you follow me? Whereas I save your life, and then, oh, you're part of my world, and your life is part of my world, and if I think you're a spiritual being, your possession of your body here in relation to me is part of my world. So I've identified with you. Do you follow me? So saving more and more lives, I expand my sense of community, communion with other lives, it expands. I kill, and I contract away from them, and the more I kill, where I don't identify with you, I don't identify with you, I don't identify with you, the more I do that, the more I assume other beings want to do that to me, and the more paranoid and closed off I become, and alienated I become. Do you follow me? It's very simple, expansion or contraction of a sense of connection. Do you follow? There was a deer just leaped over there, just ran up there. There are a lot of tame deer around here. And they come and they foal. What do you call it? They calve, they fawn. When, you know, female deer gives the thing. The males don't come here much, but the females come in the spring, and they have fawns. And they like to eat the vegan leftovers. They're vegan deer. Anyway, okay. You get it? Isn't it simple? So that's what it is. And then, second one is taking what is not given to you versus giving gifts. Being detached is the first thing about property, and then giving gifts to others, especially giving something you like, that you care about, which therefore you have to like do a little process of prying your possessiveness open to give something you care about. So therefore, that's again expanding to connect to the receiver of what you give, and clutching in and grabbing it more, you see. Then the third one is using sexuality harmfully or positively. So what is skillful sexuality? I mean, being a good lover might be skillful sexuality, actually. But the main thing is that you're not doing something harmful. And often in many societies, that's just relates to adultery. But the only reason that it's made to be adultery is that because, you know, they're in monogamous societies, then that causes violence and conflict, and people kill each other and have passion crimes. And then, do you know what I mean? Then the husband comes and finds the wife in bed and kills, or the wife comes and finds the husband in bed, and then they die or they divorce, or, you know, it's a horrible thing. And so that's unskillful, and it breaks, and then children suffer, or sometimes not. But there's a circumstantial thing about it. You know, people have different ideas, and there are different cultures. Tibet was unusual and unique, actually, in that it was one of the few polyandrous cultures in the world. There's a little bit polygamous too, but they felt that every woman should have her own house and hearth, so there shouldn't be two wives in one house usually. But some kudak or merchant who had a household in somewhere in the Chinese border and somewhere in the Indian border or in central Tibet, and who was months here and months here, they could have two families if they were wealthy enough. But then some woman, and because the brothers didn't want to split up some very scarce land in a river valley, some woman could marry two brothers or three brothers or an uncle and a nephew and things like that. And so you have the males getting along in one house with one woman, And I don't know about the rotation systems. I don't really know how they work. But anyway, they managed that without the males killing each other, which is an interesting social event, you know. And there are very few societies that where that can happen on the planet as far as anthropologists go, but Tibet was one of them. And then, of course, your monastic, either male or female in Tibet, is supposed to be celibate if they or unless they're fake. And most of them were, and that was actually an interesting population control device, in fact. And therefore, Tibet never became overpopulated, which it can't be because of the fragile nature of its ecology. And which in general, therefore, the monasticism is a very valuable social institution. Surprisingly, for Protestants, don't think so, but actually it is. But never mind, that we won't get into that. But my point is, the sexuality one is really important as the third physical one about expansion and contraction, skillful and unskillful, because of course in sexuality of mammals, it's a time when the boundary of self and other normally does melt, at least hopefully for people who can manage. You know, they kind of, you know, they give up their sense of self. They have a transcendent moment. Orgasm, even though it's not as powerful as a yogic orgasm, or heart orgasm, or brain orgasm, or throat orgasm, but still genitally organized orgasm, as Freud would call it, is still quite powerful. The central channel, the energies go into toward the tip of the central channel, at the base of the central channel, in genitally organized orgasm. And human beings kind of melt, and there is a sense in lovers of identifying with the other. So it's an expansion of self in a natural biological manner. And it, of course, it leads to, in the case of human mammals, that expansion of the self that happens to the female, where somebody else, some stranger, comes in the door and hangs out for 10 months and has to be taken care of for 20, 30 years. It's quite a thing of being melting down, you know. So to use that occasion for some situation where the other is being just used and being harmed, and there's no sensitivity to the needs or the reality of the other, is therefore very unskillful. It's abusing one of the central moments that humans build on to discover a larger sense of community and a sense of thing, and kind of controlling it in a manipulative and other, and self-centered, selfish way, if you follow me. So therefore, it's highly unskillful. And you can see, lower animals, for example, people sometimes romanticize lower animals, lower than human in a sense, just in sense of sensitivity. They are totally soul-bearing. This is the difference. You know, in the theistic Western Abrahamic three traditions, they have this idea that animals don't have a soul. They have no Buddha nature. They have no bodhicitta. They have no citta, period. You know, they're just robots. So therefore, you can eat them and use them. They're just like machines. But the Buddhists, while they can be not so great with animals and they consider them less capable than humans, but they do know they are souls. All animals were humans. Remember, the past is infinite in the Buddhist evolutionary theory. So every animal has been human. And then they deteriorated to that state where they're more isolated in their sense of being. And, you know, for example, then you're at this boundary of self and other. Where does language come from and the ability to communicate? You don't have language, I used to jokingly say. The reason humans have language is that when you don't eat someone the minute you meet them, you chat first, you know? An animal just chomp, you know, or chomped on, and there's no time to chat. But the human is like hiding in a cave from one of those predators or something, and then they're having to listen to their wives, you know, that Neanderthal guy is like... I think the Neanderthals disappeared in Europe because they didn't listen to their wives. They were like watching Rambo movies, and then the other ones were like more female directed, so they're more skillful, the homo, whatever we call ourselves. You know. So the modern one. So then you come to speech, which is this amazing thing where we connect our minds by imagining the other person means something that we relate to through a language, although it's never exact, and you know each person has their own individual way of understanding things, and the communication is imperfect. But still, it's this marvelous group mind through language which goes through space and time. Like you can read what Buddha said as remembered and transmitted, of course, through many things, as text critical scholars will tell you. But nevertheless, you can read, you can therefore share Buddha's mind through sutras. You know, but he's not talking to you directly, you think, but he's talking to some live person in front of him, but still you get some value from that. And, you know, we can read the books of Newton if we're scientists, you know, and so speech connects human beings in a group mind for over time and space in a most amazing way, and really is based on the transcendence of the self-other difference, imperfect, all imperfect as it may be. Therefore, they do say, in spite of what people think about mystics, that there's a famous verse, of all the deeds of a Buddha, enlightened being, the deed of speech is the most important, it is supreme. Therefore, the wise person always praises Buddhas for their speech. You know, there's a Zeva Kunle Sungin, Zeva Choyin Deyani. I forgot the my memory is terrible. Okay, so those three physical are therefore total secular ethics from the scientific view of evolution, naturally meaning that what you do in this life will affect your coming life. The way you are, there's a Tibetan proverb, I don't forget the Tibetan language for it, but there's a Tibetan proverb who says, if you want to know your previous life, you don't need to go to a shaman or a soothsayer. Look at your body in this life. It is the register of your skillful or unskillful actions in previous lives. And therefore, being a human, you can just, hooray, I'm a human. I have a fantastic set of previous lives to have become this incredibly complex entity and have this instrument of a human embodiment, and the mind that would want such an embodiment is amazing achievement evolutionarily, because that animal, you know, the animal who just jumps on food in front of it, you know, it has to have a sort of empathetic sense. It's like the lion are too lazy to hunt, but the lioness who sees the zebras going by and then seeing the pregnant zebra remembers being pregnant, subliminally, of course, and kind of restrains jumping on that one, even though that one would be more juicy. And the embryo, oh, that could be really, no tough, you know, everything would be delicious about that. That'd be like eating like veal, you know, like uncured, whatever. So don't give me this crap that those anthropologists do, like, or those zoologists that, oh, they're waiting for the herd to increase so they can eat more. That's BS. She has a subliminal thing. Well, okay, I'll eat the stringy, old, creepy one. So then, because that one's a mother like I am occasionally. So there's a tiny flicker of empathy and unself-centeredness of just following my appetite. Do you follow me? And from that tiny thing, over many lives, it can evolve toward being a human being, a less violent, less predatory being. And how difficult is that? Many lionesses will not have that. They'll eat whatever it is. But the one that says, oh, you know, I remember I just had like five puppies or whatever they have, you know, cubs, five cubs, you know, and that one is having cubs, you know, that zebra. Doesn't think verbally. It's instinctual. But that's an instinct for opening, for going toward more identifying with other. Do you follow me? If that's if that's what evolution is, you see, with the mind jumping from embodiment to embodiment and picking embodiments that fit the attitude of the mind. Do you follow me? Mm-hmm. And skillfully expanding that attitude toward ever greater pleasure, ever greater happiness of the more sensitive, more interconnected, more social being, like the human being. Do you follow me? Mm-hmm. And finally reaching its climax in being a Buddha, where you really feel the bliss of everything. Do you follow me? It's an amazing vision of evolution. So then speech, telling the truth versus lying. If you tell the truth, you're just being transparent to the other that you're speaking to. This is reality as I understand it. I mean, you may not be correct what you're saying, but as far as you're concerned, it's the truth. So you're just being an open door for others to learn more about reality. You lie, you're creating a false reality and entrapping that person that you've lied in a false reality, and actually entrapping yourself in it, where you have to really know, a pathological liar always has to remember which lie I told to who and what it is. That creates like a whole bunch of confusion in a liar's mind. Whereas truth is just being more open to reality. And reality, of course, is that the most natural way of being is to be connected to everything. Because when you open to everything, you find that its deepest nature is clear light of the void, which is bliss, actually. So they're telling the truth versus lying, right? And then the second one is bearing, you know, creating conflict between others with speech. You know how people will sometimes, oh, you know so-and-so, you think he's your friend, but actually that person doesn't like you. And they told me that you were like, and then, oh, so then you won't be friends anymore. But that means I'm your good friend. You know, people do that. That's slandering, you know. Yeah. And so that's, again, creating conflict among others. The opposite is, you know, so-and-so, maybe they did a little bad thing to you, but, you know, they're kind of nice, and they told me they like you, and you're very cute here, and they liked your shoes that you wore yesterday, whatever. And then making them friends with each other, so expanding, reconciling, speaking peacefully, or speaking, creating conflict, right? And again, that's all in the line of expanding your communion with others, your community with others, or contracting it. Lying and sparing for slandering, creating conflict between others, and with the idea that that's aggrandizing yourself. And then third one is speaking harshly, using speech abusively to wound people, and out of anger, etc., or domineering and speaking harshly versus speaking sweetly. So that's, again, when you speak sweetly and other people like you, singing a song, you'll become a rock star. You speak sweetly enough, eventually you'll sing like Bob Dylan. People will like, you know, you can put out a record. So that's the third one. And the fourth one is speaking meaninglessly, babbling senselessly versus speaking meaningfully and educatively and elevating others, expanding their understanding, or just babbling when you don't know what you're talking about. And you know, that's like the Western one is blasphemy, right? There the main thing is to talk about God or not talk about God. So blasphemy is the big one. But in the Buddhist one, it isn't a matter of blasphemy. It's a matter of being meaningful and helpful in speaking, or just wasting the privilege of being listened to by another human being, another person, and thereby, in a sense, they're opening their mind to your thought, and then just leading them off in some useless way into some complete irrelevant thing. Do you follow me? So those are four skillful and unskillful things of speech. And then there's three of mind, and the first of the mind, they really parallel the three of the body in a way, but they're mental. And the three of the mind are being greedy about wanting other people's stuff, and want, you know, being greedy, period, or being detached and open about stuff, you know. So that's like this taking what is not given versus stealing, you know, taking versus not versus giving, you know, that's a generosity thing, but in the mind. Then there's being angry and hateful and malicious and thinking of scheming how to harm someone versus being loving. There's a way station from hatred to love, which is tolerance. Being, you know, hatred, then being unhating and tolerant of whatever annoys you, and then finally loving even the people that annoy you. So that's the second one. And third one is being realistic in your view of reality, or being open to reality, open-minded, versus being unrealistic and clinging to stupid ideas like that you are nothing, or that anybody else is nothing, you know. Or, you know, where's the most stupid one? But there are a lot of other stupid ideas. Various kinds of absolutisms, as we call it, in making, isn't that absolute thing that you become a fanatic about? And they're unrealistic, unscientific, unpractical, unsensible ideas that we get stuck on. And so those are the three mental ones. So mentally open, mentally loving, mentally generous, versus mentally closed, mentally hating, and mentally greedy, right? Which is your three poisons again, right? And they fit with the physical action. And then this is the horrible thing about Buddhist evolutionary biological theory. And this is why Buddhists want to meditate. It's why Buddhists consider psychology, the inner science, to be the queen of sciences. Because those mental things are the most evolutionarily powerful, more even than physical. That is to say, if your mind is shut down in some sort of fanatical way and filled with violent hatred and filled with greed, then that will send you in a bad future life, in a bad direction, because you'll want an embodiment that will embody violence like a cobra. You know, it might look nice, to a cobra egg, a Mrs. Cobra might look really cute to you. You could just go, you know, and then no one will bother you. Or a crocodile or something with big armor on you, you know. So you'll want to be embodied. That virus will want to embody itself in a mechanism, a biological mechanism that will suit violence. Greed, you'll be some, like Jabba the Hutt. You want to be like Jabba the Hutt or somebody who's been eating Big Macs all their life. Or drink Coca-Cola, you know. Or if you're greedy, you know, and if you're shut down, then I don't know what you become. You become like, I don't know, I never mind, I won't break names. You become a Republican. No. All Republicans are magnificent human beings, actually. And therefore they're shutting down, carrying their gun, doing all their stuff, being racist, is all really wasting that human potential that they have to be completely yogis and enlightened. Really, we should go grab Boner. I insist on calling him Boner. John Boner, and drag him to the yoga center. You know? Really. Get him to, like, stretch. Okay, stretch. Downward dog. How about getting the House of Representatives into doing downward dog? All of them. Wouldn't that be great? That really would be good. They would immediately start funding all kind of yoga centers, et cetera. Really great. Anyway, okay, so the point is, therefore, given, and also, by the way, former and future life, in case anybody doesn't know, read the near-death experience literature, read the Ian Stevenson literature from the University of Virginia Institute, where he studied over 40 years, 50 years, the children remembering previous lives, documented cases, thousands of them, archived there, but there's 10, 15 books about them, picking out outstanding cases, but there's archives of thousands of them. He has a successor named Miller, who has a book called Life After Life, about the memories of children, who's running that institute. The institute was founded by a donation of Chester Carlson, the founder, the inventor of Xerox, and the founder of the Xerox company, years and years ago, in the 50s, I think, or 60s. And there's huge evidence. Then read the Buddhist Jataka literature, the literature where Buddha himself told at least 500, probably thousands, of stories of his own memories of previous lives, how he interacted with various people that he interacts with in the life that we know of as the life of Buddha. And he illustrates things that happened to them by what happened in previous lives. Read the early books, at least, of Brian Weiss, called Many Lives, Many Masters, who was a Yale psychiatrist who then was at Miami Central Hospital psychiatry head of division or something, and had a patient who only was able to overcome her problems by remembering interactions with family members in previous lives through hypnosis sessions. And then he became convinced of that, and then more and more he does that. His name is Brian Weiss. He's become a kind of pop guy now. Some of his later ones are really a little bit out there, but they're very good. The literature of Michael Newton, called Journey of Souls or Destiny of Souls, who talks about the many patients that told him about not only previous lives that they had, but also previous barter experiences that they had. Amazing two books he wrote. He's retired now. Thousands of interviews with patients where he prodded them to tell him, well, when you died out of that life into this life, what happened in between? And then he pulls together a kind of composite picture. It's a little different from our barter tundra, but interesting, actually, how he goes to this. But never mind, I won't go into detail. But anyway, read those things, because you not only need to theoretically become critical of the idea that any continuum of energy, which is your consciousness at its coarse and subtle levels, would become nothing. That's an incoherent, unscientific statement, that any continuum can be nothing, or that any continuum can come from nothing, is a similarly irrational and incoherent statement, because nothing is not a place, therefore is not a source, and it's not a destination. And in fact, it doesn't relate to anything else, because it's nothing. It's not there. It's even the term nothing doesn't refer to anything. There's no referent of the word. It's just a negation. Okay, nothing. So in addition to that, and then thinking that, okay, there's probably a continuum, and then it's probably beginningless and probably endless. So then, this is the really big shift. This is a bigger shift. It's related to the great Eckhart Tolle shift, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. He's a friend of mine. That his being the power of now, you know, being in the moment and not anticipating everything you're worried about in the future and not constantly brooding over things you remember in the past, you know. Wonderful yoga that he teaches. But, as I pointed out to him, and I don't know if he's written anything to it, and he agreed with me, if a person is brainwashed by materialism and think that their deepest state is nothingness, the be here now means sort of temporarily be in nothingness. So it feels like a little release, but it's a false palliative. It's like a false tranquilizer because you're not in nothingness. And even when you're not thinking about past or future, future is going to happen. It's going to come after you. Past is influencing you. So in a way, there's a be here now where the now is an infinity and it contains all the seeds of your future, your mental now, and therefore you're going to be very clear that your now is going to be joy, happiness, bliss, counting its blessings. You know, the tiniest baby step increment of improving of the now. Like, you know, that now having a nice flower rather than a creepy one becomes infinitely important. There's a wonderful verse in the Samadhi Raja Sutra, the King of Samadhi Sutra, that says, who understands cause and effect, evolutionary cause and effect, will understand emptiness or voidness. Because if you understand causality really deeply, you will understand that cause and effect are empty of any absolute causehood and the effect of any absolute effecthood, or they couldn't relate to each other. Relational means everything, it fits in everything else and it always changes. So if you really analyze causality, you get rid of this tendency we have to what technically is called hypostatizing, where you insist that for this to be a cup, there has to be a real cupness in it, like Plato said. You know, it has to have an essential cuphood, rather than it's just a relational arrangement temporarily of very changeable elements that holds water temporarily, right? But we tend to reify things into having absolute essences, and especially because we reify ourselves as being an absolute thing. And so when we understand real causality, we understand emptiness. But then, this is the beautiful kicker, understanding emptiness doesn't mean you just go off and stare into space or become a mystic and leave the world and stop worrying about your aunt or your child or your relative or your problem. It means that you become minutely concerned with every tiny detail when you really understand emptiness. That's strange kicker. That's non-dualism. Because why? You know, like, I'll give an example. Shantideva has a great verse. He says, forever in my life, if someone comes to ask me, where's the bathroom? Or he says, where's something? Not the bathroom. But I was just thinking of the bathroom. I will never point with one finger and say, there's the bathroom. I'll never do that. Because when I do that, it's like I'm bossing that person. I'm asserting, I know and you don't. I'm kind of being authoritarian about it, you know. And it's like it's cutting off my relationship to that person. What I will do is I will take my whole hand, all the fingers, and I will, like when you invite an honored guest, please come in and sit down or something with my hand. I will say, there's the bathroom. And I will think, someday, now I'm inviting them to the bathroom, someday I will invite them to Buddhahood, to bliss void indivisible, to nirvana, to freedom. I will, someday, this same being, I will meet them sometime in some life. I will invite them to Buddhahood. That's because he understood causality. From that he understood emptiness, that everything, that there's no fixed thing in anything, it's all constantly moving. And from that he understood the importance of the difference in relating to a total stranger, of sort of bossing them and staying apart from them, like, yeah, I know, you don't know where you are, yeah, get over there, sort of thing, versus, you're my guest, go to the bathroom, You're my honored guest. We're part of a community, and I invite you to go there. Isn't that, it's so beautiful, isn't it? It's really great. So nice. Amazing. It's just total realism. It's not some religious. You don't have to do that because God said so, or Buddha said so. It's because the more you connect to others, and the more skillfully, and the more helpfully, and the more kindly and lovingly, the better you are evolving toward being, and the more you will be happy. And the more, and they will also be more happy, but you will be more happy. Do you follow me? So therefore, when Thomas Nagel, the great Thomas Nagel, NYU philosopher, calls for a theory of biological evolution that, of course, accounts for genetic things, genomes, not only of the person, but also of the biome, all the bacteria, the community, the millions of billions of beings that are inside us. But so that's fine. Keep that up. That's the mother's genes and the father's genes, the chromosome, blah, blah, the whole thing. That's all great. But there must be a way for the mind, for that third gene, which is the spiritual gene, the mental gene, the soul gene of the person. And it's so helpful, like a parent, you know, doesn't feel they made this baby. And therefore, it's like my product. Therefore, the father, you have to go and be a lawyer because I'm a lawyer. Or the mother, you have to be an actress because I'm an actress. Or, you know, the way people behave, you know, you have to go work in the factory in some other country. You have to be a child laborer. You have to be sold off here because you're my product. They can't do that. Yes, they provided the host body, but that being brought in its own thing from the past. And similarly, when the adolescent stands up and says, this is my life. I didn't ask to be born in this family. That's what they say in America. Yes. I'm going to do what I want. And you say, yes, you did. Listen, we were just making love one night, and you just showed up, and you crowded in there, man. And now it's all right. We set you. We love you. We like you. You're part of your love child. But, you know, you asked to deal with us, so deal with us. But, of course, you're yourself. So each side has a little something to say. I think it's very cool. I like it very much. And now, that means, you know, as Dalai said, if somebody discovers, hey, nothing is very productive. There's a lot of Americans come out of nothing. They're all going to be nothing later. Send Dalai Lama a telegram. If you have the proof, fine, no problem. But meanwhile, this already is a great description of biology that actually includes, you know, another thing about modern philosophers, even the great Wittgenstein, even the later Wittgenstein, who was one of my absolute favorites, philosophical investigations, etc., he thought that ethics is just a personal choice. Whatever you want, you know. There's no reason to do anything ethical or unethical, except what you're going to get away with or not get away with. In other words, science thinks that's, you know, naturalistic ethics, that there's sort of they think that's creeping back toward theism and nature. God is telling you, so you have to do it because God knows what nature is, etc. So they want to say that it can't be scientific ethics. It's just a choice in a culture, and it's not relevant. Whereas, if there is a reason of enlightened self-interest for the evolving being to act altruistically, for example, that's fine. You know, there's a big thing in psychology, a big debate of some psychologists saying there is no altruism at all because everybody who does something altruistic, they have a little reward in it for themselves. You know, they feel better or whatever it is. So therefore, there's no altruism. That they have a big, you know, that's their big argument, you know. And then the other ones say, oh, yes, there is, because they didn't think about themselves. Kind of thing. Yeah, but that's so stupid. You know, point is, you know, as the Dalai Lama says, if you're going to be selfish successfully, meaning get happy because that's what you want, be a wise selfish. He makes the expression like that, a little ungrammatically. He says, be a wise selfish person, meaning be a skillful selfish person. Skillful selfish person is unselfish because that makes them happier. And it makes others happier. Others like them and are nicer to them. They're going to have a better life. People will come to their funeral. And they'll like them. Right? If they go around being super selfish, nobody will like them. And they'll have a miserable life. So it's all right that there's enlightened self-interest. And evolutionary self-interest in internalizing ethical behavior and doing it because of course it benefits another person. It's what they call other, the ethicists, which is a field in religious studies. It's other regarding action. Yes, and it helps others rather than harms them, but it also helps you evolutionarily, so you have a motive to do it, a double motive. And it gives a reason to be ethical. In other words, based on science.